Good morning. If you weren't here last week, don't worry about it. I talked about what the Episcopal Church was like when I first became part of it in 1959. It was basically that it had the prayer book we've always had. I had a parishioner who actually told me that when we came out with the first proposed revision of the prayer book, and shook his prayer book in my hand and said, "This is the prayer book we've always had. I got it when I was confirmed." And I said, "What year did you get confirmed?" He said, 1928. And I said, "Would you look in the behind the title page?" He did. And it said, "Copyright 1928. I said, "You had the new prayer book then." But it was... It was, even though it had been revised in 1928, it was almost entirely the same as the American Church's prayer book of 1789, and except for portions of the communion service that we borrowed from the Scots instead of the Church of England, it was in most every way, except no prayers for the Queen, the same as the English prayer book. So, yeah, always. And we had quiet little churches. The most desirable were, of course, ones that no one knew about except the members, that looked like they had come out of England, even if they were located in West Texas. Go out to Brownwood sometimes and see a whole Victorian Gothic building with Tiffany windows lifted up and put down out in the arid plains of West Texas. Are in the 50s, because suddenly we were growing due to the expansion of the suburbs and lots of returning veterans from the war and their families saying, "You know, that old church we went to was really condemnatory and wouldn't let us dance and drink, and here the Episcopalians will." And so, in case you wonder why a lot of Episcopalians of my generation make a big deal of being able to drink, it's because we came to the Episcopal Church from churches that wouldn't let us. Well, we did, but we didn't have to hide anymore. Okay. We were viewed as, and not totally inaccurately, as the church of the upper middle class. We had the highest educational level of any denomination in the United States, though we sparred a bit with the Presbyterians about who had the most college graduates, but we were right there together. The joke was that Democrats in the Episcopal Church were inside the communion rail, and everybody outside the communion rail were Republicans. Some things never change. Though they were, if I may say so, and if you're a Republican, I don't mean to offend you, but they were that kind of Republican, more represented by Nelson Rockefeller or some of the others, Margaret Chase Smith, or, you know, not the what grew up in Texas and other places in response to school integration. And there were things happening and change in the wings that most people didn't know about, because who knew about the potential changes were the bishops and the senior clergy. And that Episcopal Church, it was the bishops and the senior clergy who knew what was going on and decided what was going on. Laymen were enabled to be part of the church's governance, but that was primarily seen as the money end. Lay women were busy running the parishes, but not allowed to vote or have any say in the life of the church, because they actually, many of them, I said last week, viewed their role as being somewhat more important, because the bishop and the men might be making big decisions, but it was the ladies who actually raised the money that kept things going and the doors open. And that was sort of it. And so we're on the brink of lots of things happening. Schools are by law to be integrated beginning in the 50s. particularly in the Midwest and especially in the South, that had not yet happened, but it was going to. And one of the first big changes for the Episcopal Church was our relationship to people who were not Caucasian. Now, there were had always been in the Episcopal Church in the United States of America African American members, but with a kind of genteel noblesse oblige thought, the basic opinion was, especially in the South, but even in the North, that they would be more comfortable in an Episcopal Church with their own race. And who are we to say they should?
Can you tell us what the difference is between the Episcopal Church and the AME Church?
Yeah, they're different denominations. Other than that, they're the same. Do you know what AME stands for?
African
Methodist Episcopal Church, yes.
Yeah.
Right. And the Methodist Church itself was, until recent years, called the Methodist Episcopal Church. Episcopal doesn't mean you're Episcopalian. It means your church... It means your church is led by bishops. Okay. They have no relationship. Well, sure, we're all Christians. They have the most important relationship, but they're not part of us. Anyhow, so that's beginning again, and in 1964, the Episcopal Church at General Convention passed a new canon. That's what we call the laws of the Episcopal Church, that said every communicant or baptized member of this shall be entitled to equal rights and status in any parish or mission of our church. He, because we had not worked on language yet, this included she's also, but, and we all knew that in those days, he shall not be excluded by race, color, or color from the worship and sacraments of the church. First time we ever said that. 1964. Now, certainly in many parts of the country, people were not shut out, and in parts of the Northeast, especially on the West Coast, there were not race-separate parishes. And where there were, it wasn't enforced by rule, but by custom. In the South, in the Confederate states, actually, the dioceses had suffragan bishops who were African American to take care of the African American Episcopalians. When this passed, the largest parish in Atlanta condemned it and left the Episcopal Church and founded the American Episcopal Church, because they believed that the Bible did not support racial mixing in church. Another church in Knoxville, Tennessee did. It was a high church place, so they formed another breakaway group called the Anglican Orthodox Church. Likewise, in protest. And some people left the Episcopal Church. Down at St. Thomas in Dallas, one Sunday, a African-American woman and her children came to church. This was in the early 60s. And the vestry members told them that they should go to St. Philip's down in South Dallas instead and turn them away. This is Father Guy Usher. Father Roper, who actually remembers more than I do. Well, I don't know if he remembers it, but he was there longer. Remembers Guy Usher very well. And the next Sunday she came again. And again they tried to stop him, and Father Usher knew by this time, and he tried to intervene, and they shut the doors on the woman. So he reported it to Bishop Mason. Bishop Mason, the next week, I don't know if he actually came out there, but by the next week, the vestry had been excommunicated, the parish reduced to mission status, and the bishop governing the congregation, and they were told they would admit that lady. And they did, and her children. And she still is there, now resting in peace in their columbarium, and remained a member. And some people left, significant number, including the vestry he excommunicated, left the... But that was going on. And I went to seminary about this time. With a fairly new 5-year-long Episcopalian, with bright-eyed and so excited, and lots of things were happening. The civil rights movement by this time is really going strong. The United States had begun sending advisors to the Republic of Vietnam, and there was beginning to be some anxiety about that among Christians and others. Over there is Babs DeLizza, who was the president of my youth group at St. Andrew's Staten Island at this time. And she can remember, we were pretty unchanging at St. Andrew's Staten Island, right?
Sure.
With the bust of Queen Anne, who founded our parish, watching over us on the side wall with the Union Jack. We still sort of were a bit old-fashioned. Yeah.
So it was a pre-revolutionary war church.
Oh yes. and in we came, and then other things were happening. There was a new bishop of Rome named John, of the 23rd John of the Roman Catholic Church. And he'd called a meeting, and there were rumors that there were going to be changes in the Catholic Church. Remember, this is the point where a candidate for President of the United States had had to defend himself about being Roman Catholic as he was running. Neither of my grandfathers voted for him, because they were quite certain that if he, on the day after the inauguration, that the Pope would be on a 707 landing in D.C. to set up his throne under the rotunda of the Capitol. This is going on. Under the surface, something known only by certain bishops and lay people, for about 25 years, a group of Episcopalians had been looking at how the Book of Common Prayer might be revised. And they were in touch with a much larger number of Roman Catholic clergy and scholars who had been working for over 80 years to try to get the Roman Catholic liturgical life reformed, among other things, such radical ideas as having it in the language of the people. And they were doing little prayer book studies, which were circulated to some bishops and clergy and experimented time to time, but nobody else in the church knew there was any thought of revising the prayer book, because we've always had it, remember? Okay? Some other things were happening too. There was a movement among American politically conservative folks towards a more stringent kind of conservative politics that came to fruition in the 1964 Republican Convention, for instance, in which there were a lot of longtime Republicans who were called Republican in name only. And that led to stresses and strains there. And meanwhile, the good old solid Democrat Party, which had been running the country since the Depression, suddenly found some people out on the left who were screaming about stuff that would make it hard for good old-fashioned Democrats like Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn to run the country the way the Democrats had always run it. And all of that going on, and we're here in the middle of Manhattan. And one evening at Evensong, our preacher was a priest named Paul Moore. Father Moore, and along with two other priests, one of them Kilmer Myers, and the third, who didn't get famous, I can remember his name, I'm sorry. He'll forgive me, he's up there. They were U.S. military veterans from the Second World War, and they had gone to seminary and looked around at the Episcopal Church in the Northeast, which is where they were from, with these wonderful old classic parishes serving the educated and the prosperous to a great extent. And then they looked, and there were also little Episcopal churches in places like the slums of Lower Manhattan, and in Harlem and in Jersey City and other spots. And the three of them had gone out to Jersey City to a dying parish where almost all the members who were Caucasian had long since fled to much more prosperous places, and that neighborhood had become a real slum. And they said, the gospel leads us to people who are poor and neglected. And they worked there in Grace Church, Newark. I said Jersey City, Grace Church, Newark, for several years. They got to know the street gangs. They revived the basketball court on their church grounds and got the street gangs into competing in basketball instead of thieving and shooting each other. When Father Myers got word one night in the depths of the coldest part of the winter that the landlord in one of the big tenement buildings had cut off the heat for the people to save money, and he got some of the people, and they found the supervisor of that building and got into the heating room where they had padlocked the controls for the heating, and Father Myers with a sledgehammer broke that padlock and turned on the heat in the name of Jesus Christ and went to jail over it. The courts threw out the case against him, but you know, and he came to preach. One of them came to preach at General Seminary, and we were like, wow, this is what it is to be a priest. We're going to go out and change the world and go to jail if we have to. And it wasn't just my seminary, it was going all over the place. And it was really exciting. And then there was a civil rights movement. In the midst of this, during my second year in seminary, Martin Luther King announced the March on Selma. And church people from all over the country planned to fly down and take part in that march. And the energy and excitement was just amazing. And the Diocese of New York called our seminary and said, we've chartered a plane and we have room for 10 of the students and 5 of the faculty to go. So we said, you know, who's going to do it? And my best friend and I in seminary, both from Dallas, flipped a coin, and he got to go and I got to pay part of his way. And and then we spent that period from the time they took off until they returned in prayer in the seminary chapel. And they landed in New York at 2 a.m. and showed up at the seminary about 2:30. We were all awake until breakfast time at 7. We heard them report about it, and the excitement and the joy when Christians and Jews, Catholics and Protestants, black and white, male and female, all together walked singing Kumbaya and We Shall Overcome and all of those songs. And I mean, the kingdom of heaven is just about to break through, you know? And we knew that as soon as we were ordained, we would enable it to happen. So, but it was a stress and strain for the church members. Yeah, lots of challenges of all sorts. Things we'd always done, things we'd grown old, were suddenly being made new, and it didn't feel very good. About that time, here start coming word out of Rome that, for God's sake, Vatican II has decided that the bishops get a share in helping the Pope run the church. That wasn't too big. But lay people were going to get to read the scriptures at Mass in English, and the whole Mass was going to be in English, and the priest was going to be turned around so he isn't doing secret hocus pocus at the altar nobody can see, so he's facing the people. And girls are going to get to be altar servers in some places. Well, not always, but, and they had included Episcopalians and Baptists and Methodists and Pentecostals and Eastern Orthodox in the council and listened to our point of view. And one weekend, the Archdiocese and Seminary of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Boston came to spend, 20 of their students came to spend the weekend with us. And their arrival was on Friday afternoon, and so they came to the Chapel of the Good Shepherd, where with impeccable, and I do mean impeccable, Anglican taste, we chanted Evensong in plain chant. And afterwards, the dean of their seminary went to our dean and said, "We've been told we've got to start chanting the Psalms and the Canticles at Vespers in English, and we can't find, and we thought, and we were told you can't sing English to Gregorian chant, so we've been saying them. Where did you get books that have the Psalms in English in Gregorian chant?" And so we presented them with a whole set of the Anglican Psalter, and you were singing some of our Catholic medieval hymns in plain chant in English. Where did you get those? So we also gave them a whole bunch of the hymnal 1940. It was going to happen. It was going to happen, and the world was going to change. It was so exciting, and it really was, if you were under 30, and even some of the ones over 40. But also lots of other things. Yeah, the March on Selma was exciting, but people were still being beaten up. People were being killed. Churches were being bombed. There was resistance. Those who lived in Dallas remember... There was Dallas was governed by a coalition of business people who kept everything from changing. In many parts of the South, parishes, and this wasn't the only reason, I hasten to say, but one of the impetuses for the growth of Christian schools established by many denominations was, especially in the South, greatly impelled by the fact that the public schools were being integrated. There were those, and I'm proud to say many in the Episcopal Church, who, when they founded church schools, also made sure they were racially integrated. In fact, some of our church schools in the Dallas area were racially integrated before the public schools. So it wasn't totally, but it really gave an impetus. It really did. And even good ideas can be misused. There were other exciting people in the Episcopal Church. There was a priest who had been a movie scriptwriter, great friends with Barbara Stanwyck and Gloria Swanson, among other people, named Malcolm Boyd. And Malcolm started writing these interesting prayer-like poems. He finally collected them and published them in a little book called "Are You Running With Me, Jesus?" The title poem, and he was so cool. I mean, God, he was cool. He went to the Hungry Eye in Manhattan, where he would, you know what that is, anybody? If you don't know, then you should Google it. It is actually interesting, and some of the music was really cool. He would, with accompaniment by jazz musicians like Stan Getz and his trio, would recite his prayer poems in bars while sipping scotch in one hand and a cigarette in the other. I mean, cool. I mean, so cool. We were going to get out on the streets. See, because he wasn't in the nice Gothic building with all the proper people doing this stuff. Here is a priest who's out evangelizing in bars on Saturday nights, you know, bringing whores to Christ. Really? You know? We're going. That was the Episcopal Church some of what was happening in the Episcopal Church in my memory in the early part of the 60s. And then in 1966, I graduated from seminary and came back to Dallas, Texas, to the Diocese of Dallas, whose bishop's idea of expanding the church. We had gotten this bishop, Bishop Mason, in 1946, who came when Dallas, I mentioned this last week, Diocese of Dallas, the old original boundaries, so from Wichita Falls to Texarkana down to Hillsborough and Brownwood, all of that, there were only 25 Episcopal churches. And he said, I will found 100 parishes before I retire. He only made it to 86 that survived, founded a few others that crashed and burned. But one of his ideas was, I'll take these brand new young men, and we were all men then, and almost all of us young. In those days, the Diocese of Dallas was ordaining 12, 15 new clergy every year. I mean, and straight out of college in most cases, almost all the cases. And I will stick them out in a struggling mission church as beginning as transitional deacons, and that mission church partnered to a parish, and they will on Sunday morning conduct the short form of morning prayer and the beginning of the Eucharist, and the rector that supervises them comes scooting into the parking lot in a shower of gravel in time to pick up with the Eucharistic prayer for Eucharist. And that was the model. And I went to St. John the Divine in Burnett, Texas, a little cinder block building that held 50 people with a old-fashioned SD pump organ that had been hooked to somebody's vacuum cleaner so you didn't have to pump. Lived in a 10-by-8 bedroom with a 6-by-6 bathroom, a narrow hall, and then an 8-by-8 kitchen with a little Formica dining table, and that also was the altar guild sacristy. So, the time that I was slept in on Saturday morning and was taking a late shower when I heard the altar guild come into my kitchen or their sacristy to do stuff, and I'm going, what do I do now? Should I tell the other part? Because I had just turned off the water, so they weren't even going to hear the water. Say, oh, Father Michael's showering, and give me a little privacy. I just turned off the water. And I'm going like this. And one of them says, I think I need to pee right now. Father Mayerman's not here. I think. So I'm inside. Here's the shower, and there's, what's her name? She was one of the, it was one of the two English women, the younger one. Anyhow, she was an English-American serviceman bride. So I just waited, and they finished their work, and once they were gone, I got dressed in a hurry, sneaked out, ran around the other way, and came in the front door and said, hi, how's everybody? It was interesting. It was great fun. And the summer, in June, we'd be having services, and our church would sit down in the middle of a wheat field when the combine harvesting the wheat would come right by the window during the sermon. Yeah, all of that stuff. But I also was, because the Bishop Mason said, well, they're young, they can do more than one job, so I also was the curate at St. Stephen's, the parish that sponsored me, whose rector oversaw me, and the part-time chaplain at Midwestern State University, and the good thing that came out of that was Cherry. I said, this is going to be cool, because we're going to get together and we're going to read Are You Running With Me, Jesus, while we smoke and drink, and are really cool, and we're going to get lots of students and bring them to Jesus and change the church and the world all for the better. And we had Joan Baez and Bob Dylan to help us with this evangelism project, and it was fun. It really was. That's some of what I experienced. It was really interesting. The Episcopal Church in Dallas was an interesting place in a lot of ways. It had a lot of good things going for it. For one thing, every university in the diocese had a full-time Episcopal ministry, full-time priest. And when I say we were ordaining a dozen or more people every year, it's because these kids who were wet behind the ear Baptists from, you know, Podunk would show up at North Texas State University, and they would, one way or another, discover the Canterbury group over at the little St. Barnabas Church on the on the edge of the campus, and dynamic, exciting priests would fill them with excitement, and they would be confirmed and go off to seminary in many cases, yes.
How many priests are ordained every year now?
Four or five.
Father Michael, would you please tell the class where Midwestern State University is?
Well, everyone knows that. In Wichita Falls. Where else? And why would you be interested, Chris and Jennifer? Y'all didn't go to Midwestern. You went to old TCU, didn't you? Yeah. Terry Roper might remembers a whole lot of this as well.
It might be helpful if people to remember that the diocese was not divided then.
No.
We had all of Fort Worth as well as.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. When I had a meeting with the bishop, that first year, I got in my car and drove from Burke Burnett down to Dallas for a 1 hour meeting with the bishop, where often was telling me what I was doing wrong, occasionally what I was doing right, and then I'd get in the car and drive back. Maundy Thursday, pile in the car early morning, drive down to Dallas the cathedral so we could renew our baptismal, our ordination vows, jump in the church, race back to Burke Burnett so I could, do one Maundy Thursday service there and then over to St. Stephen's to do another one there. Yeah, sure. That was just it. I got a $25 a month auto allowance though, so. Gas was under 25 cents a gallon. So that's, and I did have a really cool 67 Mustang. And I modeled my hair after the Beatles. Another thing about this diocese was that it had historically been on the high end of the spectrum of churchmanship. Most of the parishes being simply high, but a significant number being altitudinously high Anglo-Catholics. And Dallas saw itself as being somewhat different, not only somewhat different from the other dioceses in Texas, but definitely better. Which played well into the city of Dallas's own attitude towards Texas. I'm sorry, but you know, Dallasites think they're superior. One thing to know also about all of that is that we were beginning to see some cracks even in that, because it was getting more expensive to do seminaries and to do college chaplaincies, and by the time we got into the 70s, we saw some college chaplaincies being cut back to half time, and the seminaries were getting more expensive, and also we were getting fewer younger still men putting themselves forward to the priesthood, maybe because of the gradual evaporation of Canterbury clubs, and we started having to depend on older recruits to the priesthood who would be educated not in a seminary with all the formation that entails there, like Chris is getting, with regular worship and a whole community life, and doing theology 24 hours a day rather than two classes a week. I'm not putting down some really fine priests in the Middle Ages and older came out of that, some really, really good priests. But there was a lot of formation that they had missed. And some Anglican identity, to my point of view, began to be diluted in a lot of Episcopal churches, and not just in Dallas, but throughout the Episcopal Church. But then I'm a traditionalist conservative. I know I sound like I'm a radical liberal, but I'm not. Okay. Okay. So, sum up. When we get to the beginning of the 70s, the prayer book revision came out of the closet, and everybody said, "What? Who knew that?" And we had that little book called The Liturgy of the Lord's Supper. It was 16 pages stapled together, and the bishop in this diocese, one of the wise things Bishop Mason did, I think, is he said, okay, he never made it quite clear whether he liked the idea or not, but he said, we're going to do what our church is doing. This is in the days when the Bishop of Dallas was proud of being an Episcopalian and felt it was incumbent on us to be with the whole Episcopal Church. And he said, so, every parish in the diocese, like it or not, will use this for 6 months as written. And then, at the end of those 6 months, then you will use the 28 prayer book. And then he said, as written. Scared the pee out of the Anglo-Catholics because they'd been adding a lot of Catholic stuff into the prayer book. And their people thought that was the prayer book. And they were saying, what? The prayer book says you sing glory to God in the highest at the end of the Mass? The prayer book doesn't say to sing blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord? Prayer book doesn't include, O Lamb of God, that takest away the sins of the world? Oh, really? Oh, we didn't know that. And in my experience, and a lot of the clergy I knew, before that 6 months of using the 28 prayer book that followed was done, I had parishioners saying, can we go back to that other book? It feels better. Not all did. Ralph was still shaking his 28 prayer book in my face. But And it moved apace. So I'm going to talk about liturgical revision next week, but that happened in the 70s, but also some other cats that got out of the bag at the same time, and some of which are still leading to some cat fights in the Episcopal Church. But it's been a fun time, hasn't it, Father Roper? It has been a fun time these last 50 or more years. Okay, so thank you all very much for being here today.